This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 109, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Tony Prestedge, Deputy CEO and former COO at Nationwide, to discuss bringing the human being back into banking. That sounds like a good topic. Although, come to think of it, even if some of the folks I've worked with over the past decades didn't seem entirely human, most of them did. So maybe this isn't a tough topic, as the humans never left. I've always tried to avoid conferences, but when my guard drops and I find myself at one, there's bound to be some uber techie saying that computers can take over the world and do everything. Yeah, right, sure. But certainly there's a long-term downsizing thing going on. I lose count of the middle-aged bankers I met over the past decade who told me about the latest halving of the department and consequent doubling of their workload or some such. My favourite comment to a late 30-something from their American boss, having halved the resources in the department, was, "I see this as an opportunity for you to show your commitment by delivering more with less." Oh, God. I think I would have dipped my hand in my grab bag of Anglo-Saxon words and taken up door-to-door brush sales at that point. Anyway, it all depends on your line of business, I guess. We're rounding out a run of three top-notch incumbents with this episode, with a look at that rarest of things, a building society, or mutual to those you elsewhere. Mind you, a mutual that is so big, were it to be a company, it would be in the FTSE 50. Not just that, but they tell me they are the world's largest building society, and that, to the Nationwide, this bringing together of people through technology is the absolute 21st century definition of mutual. I look forward to understanding what that means. If the last episode covered credit cards and how they're getting more virtual, not many human beings in the loop there for some time, and the episode before that, Metro Bank, blended physical with a virtual, where does the UK's largest savings and loans, to use another phrase, sit? Tony tells me that human beings are important, which is good news. But as he was also in the past running IT amongst many other things, I'm sure that he knows that computers are important too. How does this balance out? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Tony. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So we've had a fascinating conversation here. We're in One Threadneedle Street and looking over the Bank of England. And we've discussed so many interesting things. I should have been recording it on the podcast. I've completely forgotten what the lead-in topic was. I think it was something about sex, drugs and rock and roll. But as you're a big co-man, it's probably none of the above. But maybe it was the sex bit, in a way.
We were talking about gender, Mike, actually, not sex.
Oh, I see. So you can actually tell me, because in the past there used to be a similar thing, actually, but I think from what I read on Twitter now, sex and gender have become different things.
They may well be. You're not going to take me into that conversation.
Well, actually, it is interesting and relevant because I've mentioned Jordan Peterson in the past once or twice, and Bridget, my partner, read his book, 12 Rules for Life, and the one thing that she sort of disliked massively was that he equated the feminine with chaos and the masculine with order, which wound her up no end, of course. And what he should have said, he needed just one paragraph, which is, and I heard him say this in an interview actually, which is that you have to remember that male and female and masculine and feminine aren't different. So for example, in all these foreign languages that we don't speak particularly well, they have masculine words and feminine words, but they're not kind of male and female and that kind of stuff.
I'm not sure they are. And certainly in my marriage, if I look at order and chaos, would be... it's a serious point we were talking about. I feel really strongly that gender diversity, or diversity in its broadest sense, people with different thoughts, different backgrounds, different education, bring something unique to decision-making in that sense, and businesses are healthier as a result. But when I look at the gender diversity issue, actually, I think more men should be getting involved with it. It's not an issue for women to sort for themselves. It's an issue for society to sort. And it's definitely not about quotas in my mind. It's about open-mindedness of real difference. And I feel very passionately about it.
Yes, it's an interesting point. I mean, it has been a sort of debate that's been evolving for some time. We'll come back to sort of human beings and technology connecting them or disconnecting them or making them more tribal in a way. And it's become sort of quite contentious, I think, particularly after the recent elections in the States. But even before that, in terms of there being gender studies degrees in America and how it's looking at it, we've both been in the city for some time. And I firmly remember that when I joined Clark & Benson Investment Management in 85, some 30 odd years ago, that was the year they took the first, actually, they're probably the year they took the first graduates, actually, but certainly the year they took the first female graduates. And so some 30 odd years ago, I was with some of the first women joining investment management business and all that. And I've seen how it went over the years. And it's, in a sense, in one way, it's a very simple topic, I was about to say, because the world's only made of men and women, but you're not allowed to say that anymore. That's probably hate speech or something like that. Men and women or anything in the middle. So in a sense, it's actually fairly straightforward, but it gets very heated and I'm not quite sure sort of where it's going in a way.
It does, but it is a simple subject, isn't it? But for me, it's a very basic thing. As a senior male in an industry, when I'm hiring, if I say I want a shortlist and that shortlist is going to be diverse, I'm always going to pick the best candidate. But it means the search company are really clear I want them to search hard for the best people available, not those that look like me, think like me and come from my own background. And in that sense, and I had an experience, it really lives with me. I sit on the board of something called Opportunity Now, which is part of the UK's Business in the Community, a large-scale business charity in that sense. And I turned up at this, and it's their theme around gender diversity. I turn up, and I was the only male in the room. And there were some very, very, very talented, very senior females, and I was the only male in the room. And what struck me was the ability for me to bring a different perspective as a man to a conversation that says, actually, to engage me, for me to be interested in this, for me to care about this. And therefore, as a leader of a business of 18,000 people, to do something about it, I've got to be inside the tent trying to find the solution rather than outside.
Yes, it's a good way of looking at it, which is that it has become a sort of kind of one-sided issue, but it's to everybody's benefit. And as I mentioned many times in the podcast, I've got two daughters, and actually sort of the older one has got 1 year left at university, and I'm sort of trying to nudge her in the direction of, funny enough, despite the fact that both her parents are in the city, or probably because both her parents are in the city, the last thing she wants to do is do anything with FS, etc., as you do when you're young, but then you realise you've got to get a job and da-da-da-da. And, you know, it might be nice for her to try and sort of, you know, the fintech world and the sort of indies and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm absolutely pro, as I have been for 30 years, pro having more women in finance, should they wish to. My younger daughter wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. And it's unclear how to make that happen. I mean, going back to Jordan Peterson, as I quoted before, the interesting analysis, and most psychologists are kind of left-leaning, so they weren't trying to find this outcome, which is that if you rank societies by the amount of effort they've put into making things gender neutral, which Scandinavia comes, you know, on top, and you know we're not doing too badly, but we're not as great as Scandinavia, etc., etc. Then the interesting phenomena becomes that you get greater gender distinction. So the ratio of male engineers to female engineers is higher in Sweden than it is here. The ratio of female nurses to male nurses is higher there. So it's a very complex phenomenon. I remember telling a friend of mine who's sort of read The Guardian for the last 50 years this. She spat her coffee out. So it's a very complex thing. And I wonder in a way, and you can tell me that I'm being sort of old-fashioned or wrong about this. I've genuinely tried to, and virtually everybody I know is like this. I don't really any longer, probably because I'm just old, half the time I don't notice whether people are men or women. I mean, that sounds silly. In the same way, I don't notice whether they're foreign or not foreign in old money or colour or anything like that. And the challenge is getting diversity, because it's very easy to do the kind of like Top Gear spoof of BBC where you've got sort of one of every nationality sitting around the table. You know, somebody's sort of disabled and somebody's this nationality and that nationality and that kind of stuff. It's very easy to get that token diversity. But if they all bloody think the same, then actually you've kind of almost not got anywhere.
Yeah, I agree with that. Look, once you go down the route of gay, straight, black, white, male, female, then you've lost the argument altogether. I guess my point is, when I looked at this business, and it's why I became so passionate about it, we have 18,000 people, we have 15 million members, and when I and others joined, less than 15% of the senior leadership team were female. And what it did mean is that there was a risk you had group thought. Yeah, and there was no challenge, and the status quo persisted. So when you wanted to drive the organisation forward, or you wanted a different perspective, there weren't enough different points of view at the table. And I look at this business now, and moving forward a few years, where we have 40% of our senior females as colleagues. It's not that we're a better business because they're women. We're a better business because there is a different narrative that exists and a different conversation that takes place. We are not doing anywhere near as well as we need to when we think about ethnicity or other dimensions. You have to start somewhere. But I guess my primary real energy in this is about, if you end up with this becoming an issue, which is about female-to-female conversation, when, sad though the truth is, the majority of senior appointments continue to be made by men, it doesn't become a man's problem. It doesn't become something that's a shared issue. And I think that's really the heart of what we're going to talk about today, which is how do you move beyond that kind of tribalism, that sense of one view or the other, into something this is about genuinely socially owned by all.
Yes, astute listeners who remember every word I said will obviously have their sort of autism or some sort of strange thing like that if they remember every word I said. But in my New Year special this year, I emphasised the Lakota phrase, Native or North American phrase, Mitake Oyasin, means all our relatives. The whole world is our relatives. There probably needs a small footnote in that some of them are complete nutters and you want to keep well away from them. But everybody is our relative. And certainly for a B2C business, a huge business like yours with masses of customers, you do need, I think, to make more effort than anybody to bend over backwards and understand the whole market and not just serve part of it. And I think I've long since lost interest in the sort of the arguments of sort of feminism or menism or all this kind of stuff. And to me, it's much more about what kind of practical policies can one put in place to maximise everybody's opportunity. So having two daughters, I want them to have opportunity in anything. I don't want them to be held back because of their gender. But equally, I don't want them to be pushed because they happen to be female, because I don't think that's sort of good for them psychologically. And I think a lot of this actually does come back to biological matters such as childcare and time out and how businesses can support women when they were going through the phase of, for the sake of, let's say, a woman has three children over 10 years. Well, the bloke sort of tends to stay in the business and will get ahead. And, you know, how is that coped with? And certainly, I call my wife after having children, I was about to say it's a very female thing. Anyway, I'm old-fashioned enough to be able to say those kind of things. You know, but she was very nervous about going back in a way that men aren't. And I think this behaviour has been shown many times in interviews, that if you ask a bloke, can you do this job? Oh, I can do that. Even if he's never done it before. Whereas you ask a woman, oh, I'm not so sure, actually. It's just in terms of how they're coming over in interviews. So it's a complex topic. And I'm very pleased that sort of businesses are looking at it. And I guess it's work in progress. And for me, I'd just like everyone to be a bit less hysterical about it and the more, as you say, one tribe. Yeah. We're all in it together. It's all of our benefit. Look out the window. I don't care what colour people are. I don't care what gender they are.
The reality is, I accept it's about policy, but if a senior male hire stands up and says, this is an issue I care about, it's an issue I'm prepared to talk about, it's an issue I'm prepared to sponsor, all of a sudden, the conversation changes. Yeah, and because the conversation changes, behaviour can change. And because behaviour can change, then policy will follow. So I wonder whether it is as complex as sometimes it is presented, or whether it's just about finding organisations with the right culture and with a leadership team who behave in a way which means you respect everyone equally rather than value them differently. And we could talk about this all day.
We need to move on. So going on to business. Yes, this is a business podcast. So you've done all sorts of things at Nationwide and before. Paul, do you want to sort of briefly run us through?
Look, I've been at Nationwide now for 10 years, and before that, grew up for my entire career in Barclays, which was an amazing academy of learning, actually. A part of my attraction of coming to Nationwide was the mutual business model. So that real sense of being owned by 15 million customers, directly accountable to them, and a colleague base of 18,000 trying to do the right thing as a result. And that's actually not about mutual being better and PLC being bad. It was just a different business model, but one that I've fallen in love with since I've been here. And since I've been here, I've had a great array of jobs, but of course, for a long time as a COO, had that great privilege, I say in quotes, of leading through the largest replatforming of an underlying banking platform in Europe with SAP, not something I'd choose to do again, I need to tell you, and then right the way through into how do we build out our front-end digital piece. But all the way through, the thing that's continued to excite me, and I guess that's what we're talking about today, is how does technology start to bring people together rather than divide them?
Yes. Coming on to something, of course, then, as I was saying before, there are clearly ways in which technology enables human beings to come in, and there's ways in which technology replaces the human beings. So starting with this super big picture thing where you were saying that technology is very important to a 21st century mutual.
We were talking about this before. The thing that excites me at the moment about what's going on with technology is I've been in this industry for 25 years, and for the majority of that time, technology has got in the way of having a conversation. So if you went back to the advent of telephone banking and then the introduction of all sorts of systems that meant it became automated, of course, what it was about driving efficiency. You then think about the initial advent of things such as internet banking. It was about moving simple transactions. Now, that trend will continue. That's not a trend that's going to finish. And actually, it drives convenience and it drives efficiency for firms and it drives great outcomes for members and customers in that sense. But actually, in the last three years, it's really struck me that the next generation of technologies are bringing people together. So when you think about the advent of video, which means actually you can talk to somebody from your home, from your desk, while you're travelling, in your banking institution, and you can look them in the eye and you can get a sense of who they are. When you think about the advent of the introduction of chat into mobile app banking, which means actually you're not waiting for long responses where you're mailing. And we're testing systems at the moment, for example, where we've got colleagues in branches, and people will talk a lot about the death of the branch, which I don't believe, but actually you do have to make sure the branch is productive. Well, we've got colleagues in our branches who are able to deal with members through mobile technologies. So rather than them being big centres of people doing this work, actually you can start to devolve that into your high streets of the UK. But it isn't just about the relationship with the customer. I also think it's true about the supply chain. So if you went back 5 or 6 years, procurement was king. You were buying big tech. It was about contracting in the right way. Of course, when you look at fintech now, so much of this is about looking each other in the eye and saying, is this a company or a fintech we want to partner with? Are our interests aligned? Actually, can this product help me scale in a way that's going to help my membership? Can my investment or ability to scale help this business to do so without me seeking to overwhelm it? And then you take that to the next stage that says, and how do we work with universities and other educational establishments to start to bring through the next level of tech talent for the UK? All of those things, whether it's about technology connecting us as a society with our members, or us as a society connecting in a different way with fintech on a cultural basis, on a personal basis, even on a friendship basis in that sense. And then right down to, and then what does that mean for connection to society as a whole? It feels like technology is starting to bring people together rather than divide them. And we were talking about tribalism earlier. I think there is an element in social media, for example, that people take one position or another. I accept that. I don't mean that bringing together within your small cohort. I genuinely mean at the one-to-one relationship. Does the CEO of this fintech and I as a buyer in Nationwide like each other, trust each other, and think we can do business? Actually, that's starting to mean more than the contract that sits behind.
Okay, so that all sounds good. Just trying to deconstruct that. Maybe one thing that's sort of implicit in what you're saying, which is that, let's just use the phrase automation. Previous podcast was on credit cards, and Nick Carrigan from Barclaycard was talking about 1966 when they introduced the first credit card over here, and the whole decades-long journey that they've had to where they are now. And if you look at credit cards as an example, it's got more and more automated, and transactions have got sort of simpler and simpler to the stage where you've got these virtual transactions where you click a one-click buy on Amazon and you don't actually do any payment thing. You just go, oh, I want that. And yep. Amazon knows how you're going to get it. Or you get it in an Uber car and out of an Uber car and nothing actually has to be paid. So kind of payments have become invisible. So are you sort of predicating in your perspective that, let's just call it commodity transactions, I don't know, getting cash out or putting cash in or just very, very simple stuff? Paul Weisberg from Metro Bank a couple of episodes ago was talking about the fact that they're not opening a bunch of branches on the high street so I can go in and deposit 20 quid in my account. That's kind of commodification. The commodity stuff just becomes all digital at one end. And at the other end, a lot of what you're talking about is the fact that even if, shall we say, computers do everything in terms of transactions, you're still left with the fact that all the business has to be done by human being.
I agree with you in part. What I would say, though, is why can't you talk to somebody through an ATM when you're drawing cash out if you choose to? If you happen to be there to say, actually, whilst I'm drawing cash out, there is a question that I have. Why can't you access the ability to talk to a person in that sense? And when you're in a branch, of course, and I agree with Paul, actually, I listened to his podcast with you, that this will be about driving simple transaction. But actually, the sheer fact that people still want to go into a physical environment is because of the human relationship in that sense. But I guess I don't really mean that. What I mean is, when you're making a payment, of course you can automate it. It needs to be efficient, it needs to settle well, you need to be protected from fraud. But when you're buying your first home, no matter what you think, people still want a conversation. When you're figuring out what you may want to do about long-term pension planning for the future, when you're figuring out how might I save for the car that I want the deposit for, there is a conversation needed. And of course you can automate that. You can put all of the back end into perfect automation so it runs smoothly, and you should, because that allows you to put benefits elsewhere. But when something goes wrong, or when there's a conversation that you want to have, you still want to have it with a person. And what technology is enabling us to do, all of us to do, is put people back in front of people.
Yes, and I definitely get that. So let's try and come with a different model then. Maybe see if you should sort of subscribe to this model more. On the one hand, the simple transactions are kind of disappearing, and that's good. My simple answer to why I don't want to chat at the ATM is that an ATM is a very vulnerable thing. You've got your back to the world from where a threat might come late in the evening somewhere. So I would only be standing around for ages with my head in an ATM machine. I'd personally feel uncomfortable, but going into something. So you've got this, anyway, you've got the commodity stuff where I just want to tap something on my phone and I really don't want a human being at all. And it's like, I don't know, there's a top table or something. I can book a restaurant thing.
Yep.
That's so much easier. I much rather do that and speak to somebody on the phone.
Of course.
So we get the commodity end and that's happening. Right the opposite extreme, you've got all the business stuff where businessmen and women need to get together and discuss things and structure things and make things happen in the world that haven't done before. And then in the middle remains the sort of the value-added transaction, the complicated thing, where in a way FS meets the real world. So your example of mortgages is where it meets bricks and mortar and the very difficult buying chain and process in the UK. And pensions, God, I had 30 years in the FS. I don't understand pensions. They, you know, keep changing the rules. Massively complex. I really need advice around those. And perhaps also using that in the sort of communications sense. An example that Bridget went to see Obank this week, not Metro and not Nationwide, about something that she needed to do without giving too much away. And very helpfully, that bank didn't actually know it, but they got someone from another branch to walk over to this one and see her and discuss it. And, you know, they were very helpful and all that kind of stuff. But that's pretty old school, walking a bit of shoe leather from A to B.
But you don't need to do that. Go downstairs today into Threadneedle Street. And because of the advent of in that instance, Nationwide Now for the new technologies, if there's a member who chooses to continue to use the physical environment, wanders today into Newcastle and says, I want a conversation about a mortgage or long-term savings or whether or not this is the right place for my current account, and there's capacity downstairs in Threadneedle Street but not in Newcastle, then you can talk to the person downstairs. You know, in reality, what that does is drive much better outcomes for members in that sense. It allows you to get service when you need and better productivity. But at the heart, it's when you see two people have a conversation. I mean, I've genuinely sat and watched our members use these technologies, and you see them at the end almost stand up and want to shake the person through the screen. That sense of human connection has been created, whilst also for us, through technology, driving a better experience and efficiency at the same time.
And just hearing you speak, I get a genuine sort of feel that there is a different thing going on with mutuals, which, correct me if I'm wrong, are businesses who are owned by their customers, as it were, as opposed to businesses like banks who are owned by shareholders who are sort of far away. I mean, I sort of slightly think of shopping at Waitrose being a bit middle class. They're not doing so well recently. And Waitrose is a sort of somewhat down that direction, you know, owned by their staff and they've all got things. So you having been at, no detriment to Barclays or commercial banks or anything like that, but you having been in a PLC organisation and now in a mutual, and you've been in both for quite a long time, what's your sort of difference of the feel around it? Because I think that sort of, you know, encompasses where you're coming from slightly.
Yeah. At its heart, you take the word mutual where it says serving in the interests of both parties. That is the point of difference. I was in Birmingham this week. I went to do a member talk back, and we had 80 members that I went to meet. And we had a conversation, and they held me to account. They held me to account and said, you've just launched a product, and it's only open digitally. And actually, some of us would like to be able to service that through the branch. They said, we see some of your competitors launching pricing on products where they lure us in on one rate, then we're there, and then they slowly take the pricing down. Tell us that you're never prepared to do that. And that sense of direct accountability to the membership is different. You know, our voting, for me to be a board director, we're voted on. Well, of course, in PLCs, you're voted on by the shareholders. Here we have the single largest democratic vote in the last 12 months through the process of voting the directors and for the agreement of the accounts and others. And so it is different. But it's beyond that, actually. There's something deep in the DNA that I guess goes right the way back to the origins of the organisation, that when it was created 160 years ago, you know, it was created in a pub, and created in a pub by a group of men. Yeah, it wasn't women who...
Well, I don't think women really did much business in the 19th century.
Neither a vote nor the ability to earn a home, I suspect.
Nor did working class men, actually. It's often forgotten that working class men didn't have the vote in the past.
And, of course, this was about the industrious class. It was about the working class men who said, actually, we can club together our savings, and as we club together our savings, we may be able to help one of our kind to own their own home. And that sense of that absolute purity of society at work, one group coming together to help another, is deep in the DNA of the organisation and remains the same today. And therefore, actually, it's a much less compromised conversation. When you sit there as a member of the leadership team here, whether or not you're making investment decisions around the long term, whether or not you're investing in a fintech where you're worried about cultural fit as much as you are long-term investment, there is something that's purer about the shortcut relationship between those people leading the organisation and those people working in the organisation and its owners, because you can walk downstairs and you can meet an owner right now stood in our branches. I can pick up the phone and talk to one on the phone. I can exchange and discuss with one through web chat.
Yes, I like this. I like this sort of mutual idea for many reasons, and your point is well made. I mean, I can't imagine CEO of Barclays, for example, turning up at a branch office and being held accountable by the people there. But as you say, in a mutual, in a sense, whilst your quote's their boss, they are also quotes your boss. So this is it's a two-way reciprocity. And I remember hearing Joe, your CEO, speak at New City Agenda last autumn, which was the first conversation. I mean, these things take some time to set up. It was 10 months ago that we were talking about doing this. And one of the conversations I had at the time with a senior member of the House of Lords and one of the political parties I shan't name. And my fascination was with the fact that in the 19th century, there was clearly something in the environment which encouraged people to set up mutual organisations because quite a lot were set up. Now, for those people, most of the listeners of the podcast are overseas, who don't know the story, then, oh, I've forgotten what it was, but it's kind of a Thatcherite thing in the 80s and 90s. There were lots of building societies and lots of mutuals and golf clubs and all this kind of thing around, which had a lot of value, and then people thought the quotes, the value could be realised by sort of floating on the stock exchange. And basically, I think I was at Abbey National, savings in Abbey National, and they floated and never got a few quid. And somehow Nationwide managed to sidestep that trend and didn't list and remained a mutual somehow. And then going back to fintech, as I was saying earlier, for whatever reason, it's very different now from the 1800s, because I cannot think of one fintech, and this is a bit bizarre when you stop to think about it, that has actually been created as a mutual. They're all limited companies. So, yes, anyway, I was talking to this sort of senior politician about what is it in the 1800s, and maybe we might actually look at what we could do in the 2100s to make more mutuals form, but then it all sort of disappeared in the noise of things.
I understand what you're saying. At a structure level, I accept they're all companies. My observation is there is a lot of mutual behaviour going on. That real sense of one fintech partnering with another, because when they come together, not in a merger, but in a partnership, they bring a better product into the marketplace. I'm not sure that mutually is necessarily about business construct, although for us that really matters. I think it is about human behaviour. It's about a mindset.
Is John Lewis Waitrose a mutual? Is it a partnership?
Partnership. So whereas we would be owned by our customers, John Lewis would be owned by their colleague base.
I see. That's true, because I don't own Waitrose, even though I shop there.
I was also reflecting on your question about the other thing that's different, is that we can choose to invest with a different time horizon in our thinking. So we, in a profitability sense...
He didn't have quarterly earnings. He doesn't have to keep going up every quarter of every year.
We do report our earnings quarterly. Yeah, this is a big business. It's got a balance sheet of over $200 billion. But actually, of course, the way that we're structured, we will talk to the markets in a financial sense and say, look, we need to make this level of profit to be self-sustainable because we need capital for the future to allow us to grow, to invest, etc. But beyond that, it's surplus. And there will be years where we will make surpluses and there'll be times where we will come below it. But actually what that means when we come to technology investment, for example, is that we don't have to, we can't afford to be flabby, but we can afford to invest in a way that says we believe this is something that will benefit the membership in the medium term. Therefore, we are prepared to follow this, even if the short-term returns aren't necessarily there. Now, as long as the business is financially stable, and we are, and we're delivering the right level of returns, that will feel different than when you're in a PLC where you really do have to, in a quarterly sense, make sure that you've got an earning cycle that's always going up.
And in terms of maximising return to shareholders, which is obviously the attitude of a PLC, and there's a whole sort of share options and board remuneration and dardy-dardy thing that's been going on for a long time, particularly in America, then, whatever the Ferengi used to say on Deep Space Nine, that the higher the risk, the higher the return. So banks, by and large, tend to gear themselves up quite a lot, going back to sort of Lord Turner's perspective on all this kind of thing and banking crises and 2008, all that, because that's the way to get the share price going through the roof. Whereas, I was mentioning before, I knew one or two chairmen of building societies, rather smaller building societies by definition, and building societies historically, and the ones that are still building societies currently, it seems to me, do not take such an aggressive leveraged position, and therefore, famous last words, this will probably go wrong in a year's time, and therefore, by and large, don't blow up as often as perhaps over-leveraged banks do. Are you less leveraged than an average bank, for example?
If you looked at our core tier one capital or you looked at leverage, we would be significantly stronger in that context by virtue of the nature of the balance sheet. But there is something more fundamental, which is in the context of our lending, 75% will always be in the home finance market. So beyond that, you're able to go into other markets, but we are established as a deposit taker and as a residential lending organisation in that sense. And because we don't have to maximise profitability, we have to optimise it. We make £1 billion a year, profitability a year. Which is not bad. This is a big
business. Many companies make a billion profit.
You have to make sure that we can make the right level of returns to be secure for the future. What we aren't forced to do is slavishly drive to the next set. And we can, and you know, Joe will talk about this, if you look back over the 160 years of the society, at each time the generation of leaders have in many ways seen it as their job to hand the business over in a healthier state than the one that they inherited. There is that real sense of stewardship existent in the organisation. But because if you don't, then you're not just failing the short-term owners, you're failing the 15 million owners of the organisation, which is, you know, when you translate it, one in four households in the UK.
Yes, and I think this kind of attitude is why I was fascinated about what it is in the 1800s that led to mutuals and long-term thinking. I mean, going back to the Lakota, I'm not sure it was Lakota, but it was certainly another native tribe, I recall, who would not make any decision without considering its impact seven generations hence. These days, there are some businesses out there that don't consider seven quarters hence. And, you know, Noel Ferguson has spoken about this one as well, which is in his recent lecture, which is that a lot of what's going on these days you can see as intergenerational theft. So, for example, the borrowing that props up the euro will be paid by our grandchildren. House prices have benefited the likes of you or I who bought them a while ago, but our grandchildren, or even our children, are a bit stuffed trying to get onto the ladder. So a lot of Western society has gone, quotes, very short-termist. Now, I'm not quite sure how that's going to be reversed out. But anyway, it is a unique opportunity to speak to people like you who have the, quite, if I may say it, old-fashioned attitude. I use that in a positive sense, which is that there is something of value here. We want to keep it going, and we're considering future generations, not just today.
I would be more optimistic, though. If you, as we will do a lot, or I will do a lot, if you sit and talk to the members of this organisation, particularly at the younger age group, you know, if I looked at the 25 to 35 year age group, that sense of social responsibility is much more pronounced than it would have been when I was in that age group. And equally, when you then get to the older life stage, we had a group of members came and saw us as a whole board, and we had this conversation about, well, there's asset value built up in property, and we imagine that the primary driver is to pass that down. Actually, people were as concerned about long-term healthcare for their parents, who didn't necessarily own a home, as they were about wealth creation for a younger generation. And I do sense that there is a social trend changing where that sense of responsibility to both matters. The only thing I would like to say, however, is I wouldn't want us to show up as some sleepy, backward organisation. The reality is we're serving one in four households in the UK, and we need to do so dynamically, and we need to innovate to do so, and that's why fintech matters. But we do it with a sense of social purpose. And we'd only work with a fintech where we felt that culturally we were aligned. We were seeking to change something societally for the better.
Yes, and I think it's a really good thing to have these conversations, and I'm not making the distinction between sort of mutuals and PLCs, because you say Paul Riseborough a couple of episodes ago is, as an individual, very focused on the social aspect, and he was Aspen Institute and all that kind of stuff, and Metro Bank uses their branch offices to do a whole sort of use their stores to do a whole bunch of community stuff and all that. And I think it is very good, you know, I'd like to see this happening more across PLCs in general, not just in finance, that business kind of moves on from just make a simple caricature of the kind of Thatcher Reagan attitude that's only about profits and you've got to keep profits going up all the time, and then you know, the more the better. Well, actually, you need to make profits as a business, otherwise you don't really last. But moving on from that to a broader conception about their place in society as a whole. And you know, you started with sort of the gender stuff, and it would be very easy for someone in your level just to avoid the topic completely because it's a bloody minefield, because somebody will get hysterical somewhere and say you shouldn't have said this, or that's a rank attitude, or da-da-da. But I think that, and going back to your point there about that it's time for sort of men to speak up on this kind of thing, that I think it is necessary, going back to risks, it is necessary to take risks and to go beyond the safe to try and make the world a better place, not just make a few more quid for you and your members, which you need to do.
I agree with that. You know, when I get up in the morning, you can either view working in financial services in one way or another. I genuinely do not believe there is, alongside technology and health, more important industries. Because what finance does is allow you to secure a home, figure out how you save for your future, secure your long-term financial planning, support your children. So, you know, and somehow over time, it's been categorised as the devil incarnate as an industry that is there to destroy society. And actually, it isn't. Economic health of society in itself betters everyone. The reality is there was a bunch of bad guys, and they probably were guys, that did some poorly thought out stuff that led to in part the financial crisis we faced. But the industry as a whole is not seeking to do the wrong thing. And one of the things that we're really proud of in Nationwide, I'm really proud of, is because of our scale, we are able to directly compete against the major PLCs, but we can also hold them to account. You know, part of what we do is we won't go down the same avenues that some of those would do in terms of short-term return. As a result, the industry as a whole is better.
Yes, I was smiling to myself because it's an entire podcast in its own right, in that clearly there were a bunch of bad guys, because otherwise the world wouldn't have blown up in 2008. But it's a whole podcast in itself as to who the bad guys were. I mean, I was thinking recently about why Iceland blew up again, and, you know, I have a sort of unique insights into that. And equally, going back to Lord Turner having been on the show and all that kind of stuff, there is an argument, actually, that the bad guys were playing in a bunch of rules set by regulators. But quite often, the cock-up theory of life is quite pertinent. And having seen Basel I and Basel II come in myself over time, a lot of what was done with the best of intentions, but actually it's a bit like something like Formula One or MotoGP, because it's a much more immediate thing. You see what happens. They change the rules, and actually, because technology moves so fast in those industries, the F1 race becomes really boring or something, or the engines become too quiet and it's not as sexy anymore, or something like that. You see the consequences. But in banking, you tweak this thing in Basel II. Forgotten, was in Basel II, sovereigns were risk-free. Okay, so banks bung all their assets in there because it's a great return on capital, yada, yada, yada. And then sometimes later, that has, decade later, that has consequence. Yes, anyway, another podcast entirely, but I suspect it's a cock-up theory, well-intentioned people, and some naughty guys pushing the edge of the envelope altogether.
Look, it is too long, and I'm certainly not going to be talking about the regulators, who, of course, I think do an amazing job. But there was a reality that for a period of time, the level of individual reward was not connected to the long-term consequences of the action, was the reality. And as a result, there was a drive towards short-term returns, which meant that banks did gear themselves up, and as a consequence, generated risk that led to where we ended up. But of course, it was actually a liquidity issue, not a capital issue, that led to this. It was about the loss of trust and faith in an institution. So go right back to my point around bringing people back into banking. Part of that was because those investing no longer had trust in the management and that organisation to be doing the thing, because they no longer knew them. That sense of personal connection had been lost.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very deep topic, and particularly as at the moment I'm writing about the 1800s, and for these people who don't know, in the UK, which actually was a bit lagging by the 1800s, but we started it in 1600, another story. It was only in the late 1800s, 1844, 1856, that plebs like you or I could actually form a limited company. Limited companies had been around in concept since the Roman Empire, but were viewed as so toxic, they were utterly to be avoided. So the East India Company won sort of the biggest, and if you sort of believe the propaganda, the baddest, but I think that it's a misunderstanding of what they're up to. They had to petition Queen Elizabeth for a year to set up a limited company, because limited companies, I'm speaking to a mutual, so you're not going to attack me for this one, limited companies were seen as a kind of almost the invention of the devil, because what a limited company does, for the first time in history, it protects people from the full consequences of their action, coming back to where the bad guys were around why 2008 happened and what the deepest roots of those are. Partnerships have been the way of doing business for entire history, from Roman and before. And actually, I'll give an example in the book of the Assyrian Empire. There was a VC fund in 1900 BC. You have to read the book to get into that one. But they've gone on for ages. And in a partnership, if we fuck up, we lose our houses. There's no protection. The limited company says it's like a firewall. You know, you're in it for your friend. So for thousands, for the entire history until the late 1800s, it was virtually impossible to form a limited company for these reasons. And then it was a very controversial thing in the late 1800s in Parliament. Parliament complained that the government had rushed it through, yada, yada, yada. And the interesting thing is where limited companies came from. In 1600, with the East India Company and the spice trade, another big story, don't have time to go into, was that these huge moonshot missions, you were trying to send ships around the world. They didn't even know where the other side of the world was. The Muscovy Company was set up in 1566 to try and get to the Spice Islands by going northeast from the UK. Unlucky, like it's kind of Fireside cartoon, but they didn't know at the time, you know? And the Hudson Bay Company was trying to go northwest to find the Spice Islands. Unlucky. So there were these huge strategic things. People would disappear for 3 years with your money. It needed vast capital expenditure to send people around the world for 3 years. It's far bigger than moonshots. That was the driver in the 1600s to form companies. In the late 1800s, why was it all shoved through? Why were limited companies created so that anybody could actually create them? Railroads, vast railroads. In the 1700s, late 1700s, the canal network. So these limited companies were created special purpose things for special purpose, massive infrastructure reasons. And then just because people tend not to think about it, it just continues as the de facto thing. Anyway, completely different topic for another time. But it all just sort of does mill around. And I think it's very interesting. I mean, I've heard technology before and I buy everything you say. But I think it's very interesting hearing it from a mutual because, you know, you're the kind of same person as you were when you were at Barclays, more experience and that kind of thing. But there is definitely a different feel. Well, you're owned by your customers.
Yeah, there is.
It's a bit like I'm owned by my listeners. If my listeners bugger off, nobody listens to me anymore. I have to serve them. I report to them. I do something for them. I also kind of report to them.
I live in Oxford with my family, so to, you know, three children and Lisa. And we have, as all families do, we have our habits that we go through. So Friday night is curry night. If I'm driving home and I pick a curry up and nobody knows really know what I do and they say to me, oh, who do you work for? And I say Nationwide, they smile at you. There is a sense of, you know, Nationwide is of the nation for the nation. It's deep in the psyche. But it's something that goes back over decades, centuries in that deep connection with the society that you're seeking to serve in a way that's not compromised. But the risk is, and it is a risk for us, that actually then you could become slow-paced, you could become lethargic, you could become not relevant. And in many respects, that's as big a risk as anything else because we are here to make sure that this business continues to serve society long beyond our time. That does require you to invest in new technologies. It does require you to partner in a different way. It requires you to be as relevant in 2018 as you were in 1868. And the purpose of leadership is to continue to create that relevance. And that's the thing that fascinates me most within Nationwide is you've got the short circuit nature of relationship with the membership. It's an uncompromised business model. You are directly accountable to 15 million members. And let me tell you...
15 million?
15 million.
That's a lot.
One in four households in the UK. And boy, do they hold you to account, yeah? But at the same time, you have to take some, at times, tough decisions in the interest of the whole membership, not every single member in its totality. And when you think about technology, you then have to decide how you're going to invest to allow the business to be relevant for the millennial group, right the way through to my mother at 84, who still values a branch network and still wants to save personally.
Yes, and it's fascinating. And, you know, I'm not grovelling by saying that clearly you guys have done a brilliant job. And I say clearly because it is one in four the households in the country, which I didn't know, that as a company, just were you to be a company in your own right, you'd be one of the 50 biggest in the UK, which is quite successful. And the risks you point out, I absolutely know, because the couple of chairmen I know of small building scientists have got precisely that problem. They're small, sleepy, and haven't even got around to thinking about fintech and all that kind of stuff. And you know, that's the challenge for them as chairman of those businesses. And clearly, it's not one that you guys are facing.
I mean, I was listening to your podcast from Paul from Metro a week before last, so it's not for me to big up Metro. But I was going to text Craig, who's their CEO and knows pretty well, to say, you know, congratulations and welcome to the club. And you know, maybe given that we've been around since 1860, we could teach you a few things the other way around, because it's not just the challenges doing some great stuff in this space. It's also the incumbents.
Yes, and I think that's the thing that's changed. And, you know, it's funny how these things go. And this was sort of booked starting about 10 months ago. So it is a bit of a coincidence, but I've ended up with sort of Metro Bank, Barclaycard and Nationwide as three episodes in a row. And amongst other things, that shows that, looking at it from a sort of small, new disruptive fintech, you know, small disruptive fintechs need to get their attitudes and act together and really either make an individual business themselves or partner up with the likes of you guys. Because once the big boys get into motion, they may be sort of slow out of the blocks, but the momentum behind it, you know, it's much harder now for you to start a fintech now that the sort of the giants have woken up than it was before. So that's been really interesting. And as I say, what I've liked most is the sort of the feel for this sort of whole mutual thing. And I shall now go away and on the train home, I shall be fretting more about how come there aren't more mutuals around, because I quite like this long-term attitude and looking after Society Hill and all these kind of things. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. Said I kind of report to you guys as well as serving you guys and also serving my brand partners. I'm serving everybody today. Blue Motor Finance are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages. 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out Capital.com or download the app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So we mentioned Nationwide once or twice, and certainly more than the average episode. So you're just in the UK, so anybody abroad is unlucky and can't sign up with you, is that right?
Yeah, from a membership perspective. But when you think about your audience in a fintech perspective, we're open for business globally in that sense. We're interested in working with businesses, which is why we've recently launched a venture fund.
The venture fund to invest in?
Largely for us to partner with fintechs so that we can both invest if that's the right thing, or of course partner in a more traditional way. For those that culturally align with us, have an interest in product that we can help scale, so we understand the interests is one of mutuality both ways, to continue to transform the experiences for our members every day.
Excellent. So many listeners will be salivating at that one. So get on LinkedIn. Actually, you're not on LinkedIn. I think you're the second person on the show. You and Lord Turner are too good for LinkedIn. Unlike me, you avoid the LinkedIn spam, which sort of every day 1,000 people want to tell me about how to destroy banking overnight in my inbox.
It actually isn't that. I'll tell you the true story, which is I had 42 attempted frauds in my name under LinkedIn, and I got to a point where I just withdrew because people were attempting to sell my services unfairly.
Ah, yes. I actually did Google, and I came across one of them on LinkedIn.
I'm sure.
Yes, I'm so impoverished in London fintech podcast towers that nobody sort of tries to defraud me of anything. It reminds me of the story, actually, just to wrap up. I went somewhere and some guy played all sorts of weird instruments, one of which was a banjo. And he said, have you heard the one about the banjo player who parked his car in a very dodgy part of town? And he came back and he found it being broken into, and on the back seat were two banjos. Anyway, that's like the London fintech podcast. Good. So that's been very interesting, Tony. I've really got a good feel, and I hope the listeners have. And it's really important, especially with sort of me writing my book at the moment, it's really important actually to take a big step outside fintech, because this is not something that fintech has considered, and realise that de facto we kind of fit into the sort of shapes that society give us, whether it's gender roles or whether it's limited PLCs or that kind of thing. But there are always different shapes again, whether it's gender roles or whether it's sort of mutuals and all that kind of stuff. So fascinating topic, and thank you very much for that, Tony.
Mike, I greatly enjoyed meeting you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.